Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Conservative Political Action Coalition conference kicked off today in Budapest, Hungary. It is the first time the U.S. CPAC conference has been held in Europe. This morning's keynote speaker was Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who said conservatives in Europe and the United States must fight together to, quote, reconquer institutions in Washington and Brussels from liberals who threaten Western civilization. This is according to Reuters. He said, quote, we must coordinate the movement of our troops as we face a big test. 2024 will be a decisive year, end quote. So who is Viktor Orban? He was the first European leader to endorse Donald Trump's 2016 presidential bid. In April, he won a fourth term in office. Since 2010, Orban and his far-right Fidesz party have eroded civil liberties, remade the courts, and dismantled media independence to push their agenda. According to the New York Times, stories, photos, and guests are handpicked to align with Orban's talking points. Many of the largest independent news outlets have been taken over by Orban supporters. In a speech this week, Viktor Orban embraced the racist Great Replacement ideology, called the spread of LGBTQ rights gender madness, and said the West is committing suicide through immigration. U.S. conservatives are proudly embracing authoritarianism by hosting CPAC in Hungary. So what does this tell us about the direction the far right is headed in this country? Today, we are joined by Catherine Joyce, an investigative reporter at Salon and author of the book Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with the Type Investigations and author of Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Great to be with you again.
Great to have you again. And Flora Gamanvolgyi is a journalist covering Central and Eastern Europe who writes about Hungary for The Guardian. Hi, Flora. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back, Flora. Since you are in Europe and you have been tweeting about CPAC, I just read that a number of journalists from various media outlets have not been allowed in, like Rolling Stone and Vox, for example. So a lot of people are relying on video. What really stands out for you so far? Because it's later in the day there now, so day one is almost over. What really stands out for you?
Yeah, sorry, I have to correct this. I just got back to the U.S. from Europe.
Oh, you just got back from the U.S. Okay.
I spent 1.5 months there reporting, and I just got back there. And I'm also following the events there online, because there would be no point to be there, because I wouldn't be able to register for this event. No one from independent media outlets or international media outlets was able to register for this event.
Did they give a reason why?
No, they did not.
Because even the AP said that they weren't allowed in.
No, they weren't. No.
Well, what really?
They just told us that we will be able to follow the events online.
What really struck you based on the videos you watched?
Definitely when Orban has talked about the media, that they should have more media outlets, meaning the conservative community, because he has control over, let's say, 80% of the media in Hungary. So him talking about gaining even more control over that was definitely interesting. And he said that the leftist opinion can only be seen as a mainstream because the media helps them to amplify their voice. And he also praised Tucker Carlson's show, and he said these kind of shows should be broadcasted 24/7. So this was his advice to the attendees and to all these European and American guests and speakers. That was definitely interesting for me.
And Tucker Carlson appeared via video, but gave a short speech, right?
Yes. And Tucker Carlson being invited to this, and he was, you know, confirmed for this event. It was huge news in Hungary, especially in the pro-Orbán media. And it was quite a surprise that he only gave a 40-second long online video speech at this event, because he was supposed to be one of the main attractions or main speakers here, according to the coverage that he received in Hungary.
Catherine, you write about the far right and authoritarianism. What does this all tell us? The fact that CPAC is being held in Budapest, Hungary today and tomorrow. What does this tell us about the direction the far right is heading in the United States?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of coverage over the last 6 or 8 months about the increasingly important role that Hungary is playing with regards to the U.S. right and far right. It has emerged just as this, you know, absolute kind of conservative utopia. You know, the right loves Hungary for, you know, how it has, you know, banned gender studies in universities, or, you know, any sort of acknowledgement of LGBTQ people or lifestyles in schools or in content that minors could access. They like how they have cracked down on the free press and made it very hard to have an independent press there. I mean, so all of these things, and of course, you know, what Viktor Orban is probably best known for, at least in this country, you know, his very strident opposition to immigration or refugees, particularly Muslim or other non-white immigrants and refugees. And so I think, you know, Hungary has just taken on this sort of aura as, you know, this is the model for what U.S. conservatism should be. And it's been particularly embraced by a number of conservative intellectuals who consider themselves post-liberal. So not liberal as in terms of progressive politics, but liberal in terms of the idea that a democracy should focus on pluralism, multiculturalism, individual rights, that a democracy, you know, should be something that is there for a multiracial, multicultural public. And for the post-liberals, they see that, you know, that existence of pluralism as something that is not just neutrality, but that is an active threat to, you know, what they see as, you know, their traditional ways of living and heritage. And so they say, you know, if government is really never actually going to be neutral, government should come down on the side of traditional values and the religion of the majority. So they're using these ideas to very overtly push for the idea that, you know, there should be basically, you know, a government endorsement of specific religiosity in the public square, and that should inform, you know, social mores and laws alike.
Sarah, you have been writing about these issues for years. What are your thoughts? What message does this send that CPAC is having a conference in Hungary? And what does it tell us about where the far right is heading in this country?
Well, I think this has been underway for at least a decade, brought on by efforts by Republican lobbyists to create ties between the American right and the European right. And so there has been this back and forth, particularly between Orban and Republican strategists and lobbyists, to form this alliance and to present Orban to the American public, and in particular to American conservatives, as a garden variety conservative who is under assault from far left forces like George Soros or woke people or woke colleges and the like. So that they would have CPAC in Hungary is sort of a culmination of these efforts that have been taken on, like I said, by Republican strategists and Republican lobbyists in Washington for a number of years. And these efforts were designed to both undermine trust in democratic values and to present an autocrat like Orban as just a regular conservative who, like American conservatives, is under attack by the left.
Flora, what's incredible about this is the more you read about what's happening in Hungary, the more you learn beyond the headlines around the media, for example, or immigration or LGBTQ issues, which are all very, very important. But here's one thing that I just found before coming on the air, reading about Orban promising that women who have four or more children will never pay income tax again in a move aimed at boosting the country's population. He promised favorable mortgage terms for families with multiple children, support for families with three or more children to buy a car. And then the things that he said about LGBTQ people and immigrants are just horrific. Can you talk about how this has really unfolded? Because I don't know what your thoughts are. I mean, what message would you send to people in the U.S. about how this has unfolded? Michael Macy, a professor of sociology at Cornell, told the New York Times, if the water temperature increases only 1 degree per hour, it may take a while before you notice it's too hot. And by that time, it is too late. So how do you see this and how it all unfolded?
Yeah. The example that you just brought here is perfect. That's what I wanted to talk about, these nuances, because often when I read about Hungary in English language outlets, I think some of these articles are missing the point that it was a very slow process. And when they are characterizing Hungary as not a democracy anymore, or Viktor Orban is quote unquote a dictator, or similar expressions like that. My problem with these pieces is that you don't really understand these nuances from these articles and reportings. And I think it's really important because it happened very, very slowly when we're talking about the independent media and LGBT rights and all of those issues. These started to unfold since 2010, I would say. So it's not something that happened overnight, and I think it's important for American viewers and listeners to understand that it's not something that happens overnight. And yes?
No, please go ahead.
And something that I also wanted to mention, because I think Catherine Simorgh's very, really interesting, is that what do these two communities really have in common, meaning that US conservatives and Hungarian conservatives, because they're really focusing on some specific things like Christian or family values, but these are pretty broad terms. There are many things that if we would go into detail, they don't really agree on, such as, you know, free healthcare, abortion rights, gun rights, vaccine mandate, limited government, China, Russia policies. These are not laws and policies that they agree on.
Catherine, what are your thoughts on what Flora said about how this is happening very slowly? I mean, you can look back at the last 40, 50 years in the United States and what it has taken to get us to a point of basically minority rule. Obviously, it's not as extreme as what is happening in Hungary. But what are your thoughts about Flora's point about this happening very, very quickly until, boom, one day Roe v. Wade is overturned, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think Flora makes an excellent point. And I would imagine all three of us, I know certainly Sarah and I, you know, have been you know, following some of these developments, you know, both in the US and in terms of how conservatives have been making these partnerships with conservative and right-wing actors in Eastern European countries for a long time. This has been a long project that has, you know, involved kind of taking aim at institutions and activists, you know, within their own countries, you know, within Hungary, within Poland, kind of pushing people to the side. So I think that's a really astute point for sure. And yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, you know, what is bringing them together, I also think it's smart to point out that they don't always have, you know, exactly the same kind of policy agenda in mind, but that they're looking for lots of ways to collaborate around that. You know, I reported last fall on a different right-wing conference, the National Conservatism Conference that was in the US, and that had a very heavy presence from Hungary as well. Some of the same people who are speaking at CPAC Hungary this week, you know, people who were coming over, you know, officials from the government, people in media over there. And they would talk about this. They would say, you know, we have different policies on abortion, but, you know, here is the way that we think, you know, we're basically all building towards the same goal. And that was, I've been watching online as well, you know, but I'm glad that I didn't try to go to Hungary just to be locked out like some of the other journalists. But that was a theme that I have been noticing today as well, is this kind of drumbeat emphasis on, we've got to work together, we have to build this partnership. And while it could look different in different countries, you know, I think this emphasis on things like a Christian culture, which is a vague term, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean theocracy, but it definitely gets across the idea that this is not, we're not aiming for a multicultural or a pluralist culture. So I think that there is definitely a lot of signaling that goes on there, even if, you know, the ultimate agenda is not exactly apples to apples.
Just elaborating on that conference that you wrote about, you write that attendees were talking about a new shared vision, and Israeli political theorist Yoram Hazony was there. He was running the show as chair of the Edmund Burke Foundation, which hosted the conference. And you write that his purpose was basically to unite the right. And he had a proposal with an avowal that America is a Christian nation with a Christian majority, where Christians should get to dictate the country's laws and social norms. There would be, quote, carve outs for minorities, but no pretense of a neutral public square in which pluralistic concerns trump the majority's right to see its culture reflected around it. So how popular is a view like this?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really interesting proposal at that conference. That came up in a panel that was sort of dedicated towards that purpose. You know, they had conservatives from different conservative traditions, you know, people who were kind of more libertarian or neoconservative, national conservative, and then kind of Catholic integralist. And they were sort of there to figure out, can we find a new fusion to go forward with? You know, the old conservative fusion of kind of anti-communists with free market capitalists and religious conservatives, they saw it as having broken down. And so they were trying to find kind of what are the grounds on which we can build, you know, a new fusionist movement to go forward with. And I thought that was a really interesting, you know, Yoram Hazony's particular suggestion was, can we agree that public schools should be able to basically have Bible classes in areas where Christians are the majority? And it struck me as like, this seems like such a specific thing to be the basis for, you know, kind of your new conservative marriage of all these different sub-movements. But it kind of proved to be prescient, because a few weeks later, a number of people who had been speakers or attendees at that conference put out this new kind of mini manifesto saying, you know, we should, you know, we're not necessarily aiming for a theocracy, that we're going to try to get everybody to be, you know, completely on board with being, you know, following the tenets of conservative Christianity, but we want our we want a public recognition that, you know, a society is basically Christian, and that, you know, Christianity has a place of preference within our societies. And so that kind of, it is, I mean, I think just, it's another way of moving towards this broader goal, which is away from classical liberalism, away from the idea that, you know, there are individual rights, that the government should be neutral when it comes to things like religion, you know, that the government's role is to enforce everybody's right to express their own religious beliefs and culture. So it, to me, it seems like the importance there is in underscoring this move away from those, you know, classically liberal ideals.
Catherine, I know we have to let you go. I have one more question. You know, we really struggle with these issues because we, frankly, would rather talk about how to deal with the climate crisis or child poverty or homelessness. I mean, there's so many issues that we're dealing with, and yet we can't ignore all of this. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on this. How much attention should we place on these issues right now, given where we are? And then what can people do about this?
Boy, that is kind of the key question. And I would love to hear what Sarah and Flora have to say about this as well. I mean, I think this is as urgent as all of these issues are. You know, to me, this represents a pretty foundational part of the attack on democracy that I and a lot of people think that we are seeing right now, kind of the tremendous danger that, you know, our democracy in the US is in, as well as a number of other democracies around the world. So I do think as many things as we have to pay attention to, what is going on with the far right in all of these different guises really demands our attention, because, you know, we certainly will not be making progress on climate change if we lose our democracy.
Right. And any bill that is passed would ultimately go to the Supreme Court. And so we have to pay attention to the capturing of the court. Well, Catherine, I know we have to let you go. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Joyce is an investigative reporter with Salon and author of Quiverful: Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. Before we go to break, Sarah, how would you address that, those questions?
Well, I agree with what Catherine said. If we don't save our democracy, all of those other issues are pretty much off the table, right? Because if the United States, if in our next midterms, the Republican Party regains control of the Senate and the House, and if Trump or another Trump-like Republican wins the White House in 2024, we're not going to be addressing any of these urgent social issues at all. In fact, we're going to probably go seriously backwards, either slowly, as Flora described in Hungary, or perhaps even very rapidly go backwards. So I do think that it's a foundational question that Americans have to come to grips with. And not only by understanding what's happening in some place like Hungary, but understanding what's happening right here in the United States, where you know, some Trump-supported candidates have been losing in their primaries for the House, for governorships, for the Senate, but others have been winning. And some who have been winning have been openly expressing their willingness to overturn election results. So these are things that are really urgently on the table right here at home.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that after a break. Flora, how would you answer those questions?
I agree with Catherine and Sarah, and I think to the question, what you just asked, is the answer is vote, because the only thing people can do about this is cast their votes. And the other issues, climate change and all of those things that are just as much as important as our democracy, are largely dependent on our leaders. So it really depends on who we're voting for.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on how you would like us to cover all of this, where the far right is going in this country, and what that means for all of the other important issues that we need to focus on. Also, if you have any questions or comments about what this tells us, the fact that CPAC is having a conference in Hungary, the keynote speaker this morning was the authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. What does this tell us about the direction the far right is headed in this country? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us. We're at Your Call Radio. Flora Gamon-Volgyi is a journalist covering Central and Eastern Europe who writes about Hungary for The Guardian. Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and author of Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will talk about how the media are covering U.S. conservatives who proudly embrace authoritarianism. Then we'll discuss takeaways from Tuesday's primaries and the role of money in politics. Today, we are talking about the CPAC conference in Budapest, Hungary, and the direction the far right is heading in the United States. Today, we're joined by Flora Gamon-Volgyi, a journalist covering Central and Eastern Europe, who writes about Hungary for The Guardian. Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and the author of Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Flora, let's talk about how in Hungary and now in the United States, the minority is in control on many levels of government. So first off, what's going on in Hungary? According to the New York Times, to understand one of the ways Orban has reshaped democracy, consider this. When his political party, Fidesz, won the last two national elections, it received less than half the votes, yet still secured a two-thirds supermajority in parliament. The supermajority has allowed Orban to ram through changes to the constitution as part of his illiberal agenda. So can you tell us more about minority rule and how that has happened in Hungary?
Yes. I think the easiest way to explain it is that the strongest party gets votes even from places where they didn't win. I don't know if that explanation was completely clear, but the strongest party in Hungary is Fidesz. And even in districts where they don't win, they get some votes. So that makes them even stronger in parliamentary elections. And of course, gerrymandering comes into the picture as well. And I briefly touched on the media situation in Hungary, and that is also in favor of the current government.
And of course, this is very popular. This is what we see at the state level in the United States. Also, the Washington Post has a piece about this. They point out a Republican presidential candidate has not won the popular vote in close to two decades. The disproportionate power of the Senate, where because of rural urban polarization, a solid Republican majority can dominate with a minority of votes, has in turn led to a decisive conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, often the final arbiter on the country's most contentious policy decisions. Sarah, what are your thoughts? Because when you look at what's going on at the state level and at the Supreme Court, minority rules.
That's right. And structurally, obviously, the situation is different than it is in Hungary. But just the fact that each state has two senators, regardless of their population. So a state with a very small population like Wyoming has two senators, just like California does with its 30 million residents. So that leads to this asymmetry, whereby these red states that have smaller populations have an outsized voice in the Senate to enact far-right legislation and confirm far-right justices to the Supreme Court and judges to the federal courts, but also to block progressive legislation.
Right. In fact, Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman pointed out last June that Senate Democrats represent 43 million more people than Senate Republicans. But you could get 21% of Republicans blocking the For the People Act, supported by 68% of Americans. And this anti-democratic system is exactly what the For the People Act was intended to reform. And correct. This happens time and time again. I mean, we just did a show about the horrific shooting in Buffalo. The same thing is happening there. A minority in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, can ensure that Senate Republicans do not have to vote on universal background checks.
Or any other gun control legislation.
Right.
Right. And also, I mean, you see that play out in the Supreme Court, where they're poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is not favored by a majority of Americans, but because of this asymmetry in the Senate and their willingness to, you know, rush through a nominee like Amy Coney Barrett or Brett Kavanaugh, that even though they blocked Merrick Garland while Obama was still president, that they've been able to stack the Supreme Court to overturn a 1973 Supreme Court decision that is quite popular with most Americans.
Right. We have an email from Robert who says, can you compare and contrast the Republican Party's strategies and impact on our courts with the courts in Hungary? Can you talk about this, Flora? Can you give us more details about how Orban and the Fidesz party remade the courts?
They changed the judiciary system, and it is in their favor in certain instances. But it works differently than in the US. We have a completely different system. And this is also with the popular and non-popular issues that you just mentioned. Orban takes these surveys that he takes every year very seriously, and certain laws that are very unpopular wouldn't make into our constitution or into our system. So this is different because in the U.S., some unpopular measures, like when we're talking about the Roe v. Wade situation now, could have a different ending in the system. But in Hungary, I think the key is in the media situation that Orban can deliver his message to voters every time he wants. And I think these propaganda channels are making a really good job for him. So it's not that very unpopular measures make into laws in Hungary. I think it's that he has a way of convincing people that measures that he wants to take are right.
Sarah, given that you have written for many years about white evangelicals and, you know, far right extremists, gosh, when you just sit back and think about the fact that Donald Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices, and we're waiting next month, we're going to get Roe, we're going to get a really important gun decision out of New York, affirmative action, praying, there's a case involved praying on a high school football field. An SEC case came down today, a money in politics case came down to either flood more money into politics a couple days ago. Can you just talk about how significant this is to the extreme right and to evangelicals, the fact that they basically got the court that they've been wanting for decades?
Yeah, it's an incredible political victory for them. White evangelicals in alliance with anti-choice Catholics have worked for decades to overturn Roe. The other important thing they did over that time period was not only work assiduously to get justices nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court who would overturn Roe, but in the interim, working in state legislatures to pass the legislation that would lead to the test case that would overturn Roe, which is what, you know, ultimately it was a law in Mississippi that went up to the Supreme Court that is at issue in Dobbs, the case in which we've already seen the leaked draft opinion from Alito. So they worked on that front. They worked in the court of public opinion to make the pro-life label very palatable, even as they worked most recently in state legislatures to criminalize abortion, to criminalize anybody who helps somebody get an abortion, right? And finally, they created an entire world in which crisis pregnancy centers provide disinformation to women who are pregnant and seeking help, dissuading them from seeking an abortion. Often these crisis pregnancy centers are also anti-contraception. And they protested, and in some cases, there was violence outside abortion clinics. And so they have seeded this culture war, sometimes violent, in this country for decades, while they also worked in the halls of power to elevate people who would ensure Roe's demise. And all of that is coming to a head in the next few weeks or months. And it's quite an achievement. They have succeeded in reversing something that has advanced the rights of women for decades and is about to be demolished.
Sarah, just this morning, Amy Littlefield, a reporter with The Nation who's been on the show, tweeted that a coalition of state reproductive rights groups, including former NARAL affiliates, held a press conference to call for expanding the Supreme Court. Because at this point, that's really the only option, right?
Yes. And it's very interesting because if you contrast the timidity of the Democratic Party when faced with proposals like this with the brazenness of the Republican Party in doing things like jamming through nominees like Kavanaugh, even though there were still questions to be resolved about his history and background, or jamming through Amy Coney Barrett before the election, even though they said in 2016 that they could not even hold hearings on Merrick Garland because it was too close to the election. They've been incredibly brazen in achieving their goals. And not only in achieving their goals, but ensuring their continued hold on power. And in contrast, the Democratic Party treats proposals like a proposal to expand the court, like something that is violating something that is sacrosanct. And so I think that we really need to get past the idea that the Supreme Court is this apolitical entity with a sacrosanct kind of aura about it that cannot be changed or adjusted.
I just mentioned a couple cases, and in case people were wanting more information about that, I'll just read quickly from The Guardian. Win for Ted Cruz as Supreme Court strikes campaign contribution limit. Conservative majority rules in favor of the right-wing Texas Senator. Elena Kagan warns a quid pro quo corruption will be the likely result. And then the Supreme Court reporter Mark Joseph Stern with Slate just tweeted this morning about an SEC ruling, and Mark's tweet says, actually it was from yesterday, and this is from a different court, but it's a Fifth Circuit court, and obviously Trump appointed a lot of judges to lower courts. The Fifth Circuit just dismantled the SEC's power to enforce securities law. This decision is beyond radical. It is nihilistic. So a lot is going on with the courts, and just wanted to bring you that information. Also, Robert wanted to know a little bit more about the media regarding the Republican Party's relationship with Fox and similar outlets compared to Hungary's media. Florida, just to give a little bit more information on media, when we had you on last time talking about Viktor Orban winning his election again, Akos Hadazi, an opposition MP, said, Orban can get any of his lies to the Hungarian people. Even if we hire the best communication experts, the government will always win these races because they can get their messages to many more people than we can. Also, independent media outlets say that they've been targeted by Pegasus spyware. So can you just give us a little bit more information about how the media has changed in the last 10 or 11 years?
Yes, this erosion of the independent media has been unfolding since Orban was elected in 2010. After his 2010 victory was soon followed by a media law that asserted government control over the main media regulator. This means that they have about 500 or more media outlets in Hungary. Talking about Pegasus, I think that describes perfectly these nuances and this slow erosion of democracy and what's going on in Hungary. Because if you compare it to, for example, Russia, where journalists can go into prison, or you know, they can get into in worse situations sometimes, or in other countries. But in Hungary, this Pegasus spyware is about getting into these journalists' phones and in their messages. And it's not like a violent physical attack or sending them into prison, but still violating their private lives and surveilling their messages. I think it just shows perfectly what is happening in Hungary and how nuanced it is.
Well, what is the state? Like, what are independent journalists doing in Hungary? Are they able to still report? What is the status of that?
Yes, and I think it's important to say that there are still a few independent media outlets left. Most of them are working getting their funds from public funding, meaning that people, you know, are donating money to these outlets for them to be able to work. Their readers mainly are donating the money every month or every year, depending on, you know, their system. So this is how they can work, and they are doing an excellent job at reporting of what's going on in Hungary. But there are not too many of these outlets, and there are less and less every year. I worked there for almost 10 years in Hungary as a journalist. And it really felt like, I don't know if you're familiar with the game where there are like chairs in a room, and in every round there is one chair less, and you can't sit down on the chair. It felt like that game, you know, like, okay, one outlet was shut down where I worked. I got the job at another one, but it always felt like there were less and less independent media outlets where I could work.
Wow. Florida, what about protesters, people who are standing up to this? On social media, I saw there were, I don't know how many, but a small group of protesters outside of CPAC this morning. What is life like for people who protest in Hungary?
Well, you can protest. You have the right to protest. The one instance where I remember that the protest was shut down was in front of the Russian embassy. I think that is something that people can use to make their voices be heard. That is a tool. But I haven't seen very huge protests in Hungary the past few years. I mean, compared to the events that were happening there, it was surprising to me that, you know, these protests were not larger in scale. But there were a few, of course. For example, you know, about the media situation. There was one in front of the building of the public media, public TV channel, or when a news outlet shut down. There were protests and people showed up, but I always felt like these protests were not, you know, that large in scale sometimes.
We have an email from Leslie who says, why is the media and Democratic leadership silent on the Republican CPAC meeting in a foreign country? Sarah, this is getting a bit of media coverage, but in the research we've done, we haven't really read much from Democrats. Have you?
I haven't really seen anything, but I mean, to be fair to the Democrats, CPAC has been taking place in the United States for, you know, decades. And to be honest, the last few CPACs, particularly in the Trump era, clearly displayed this hard right turn, including having speakers that represent the European far right. And, you know, I don't think I've ever seen the Democrat, I don't know, maybe they have spoken out against it, but I don't think that that's a usual thing for Democrats to like talk about CPAC. So I wouldn't really, you know, necessarily blame them for not bringing up CPAC. I mean, obviously the presence in Hungary is very significant, but I think it's also really important to understand that CPAC had already taken this hard right turn, and this just kind of solidifies it and displays it to the world that they're embracing Orban and Orbanism so explicitly.
Right. We should also just mention that in February, Reuters reported that a Republican strategist filed an anonymous complaint to the DOJ alleging that CPAC's organizers, the American Conservative Union and its leaders, have violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act by failing to report money they accept from foreign organizations while promoting these groups' interests to U.S. audiences. And again, that came from Reuters. We have an email from Ted who says, please talk about the political views of non-white evangelicals. I don't think this should be overlooked because that is how these populations are left having only one choice, Trump and his approved candidates. Can you take that one, Sarah?
Well, the reason why we talk about white evangelicals with respect to the alliance with the Republican Party is that the evangelical alliance with the Republican Party is a white evangelical alliance with the Republican Party. Yes, there are some conservative or right-wing Latino and Black evangelicals, but they are, as a whole, non-white evangelicals are not as homogeneously right-wing as white evangelicals are. So I will say that, and I want to emphasize that in talking about white evangelicals, I'm not trying to exclude non-white evangelicals from the conversation. But when we're talking about Trumpism and the right and the religious right, we're really talking about white evangelicals.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Ted. In our final minutes, Sarah, I'd love to bring your comments about media coverage to our show tomorrow. We heard from Flora and what she thinks is missing from some of the media coverage around this. The fact that this can happen very, very slowly, and then all of a sudden, your institutions are not the institutions that you had a couple of years ago. So what are your thoughts, Sarah, about how these issues are being covered by U.S. reporters, specifically the message that this really sends from the hard right?
Well, I think that the political press in the United States is used to covering two political parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and they're supposed to cover both sides. The Republican said this and the Democrat said this, and here's, you know, some kind of conclusion from that. They're still largely covering them that way, even though the Republican Party has taken not only an extreme right turn on policy and ideology, but this extreme turn on whether they even believe in democracy at all, or whether they believe that democratically held elections can be overturned by their own party, or whether it's okay to have a coup or an insurrection at the Capitol. And I think that a lot of the political press is still stuck in this both sides, mm-hmm. that like both sides are good faith actors who have reasonable positions on the issues, and we're just going to present you with both sides. But things have really changed a lot. And the Republican Party under Trump has become a mortal danger to democracy. And I think it's taking a very long time for the press to pick up on that. And it may come upon us very quickly in 2024 if there's another effort at a coup. And then it won't seem like it happened slowly. It will seem like it happened quickly.
Yeah, there's a brand new report out called How State Legislatures Are Politicizing, Criminalizing, and Interfering with Election Administration from three groups, including States United Democracy Center. And they found that in 2022, there were this year already, 229 bills have been introduced that allow state legislatures to politicize, criminalize, or interfere with elections. Just quick final thoughts, Sarah. We've got about a minute left.
Right. And I think that that's important for people to understand that this is not just a Trump-driven thing, that there are many, many people who work in state and local level offices who are willing to carry out the sorts of election interference that Trump is advocating and advocated in 2020.
Sarah Posner is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations and author of Unholy, Why White Evangelicals Worship at the Altar of Donald Trump. Flora Gamanvolgi is a journalist covering Central and Eastern Europe who writes about Hungary for The Guardian. Sarah and Flora, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And you can find more information about CPAC in Hungary, along with a lot of articles about what is happening in Hungary at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to BSOL for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how the media cover U.S. conservatives who are proudly embracing authoritarianism. We will also discuss takeaways from Tuesday's primaries and the continued role of money in politics. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.